Hello, this is Bob and Cameron, Cameron McCune and Bob Dobbs, and we're starting episode number 70 in our series of trying to figure out what was Donald Trump? What is he? How is he connected to the tech body? And so Cameron and I were already talking, and make that point again, Cameron, about how important it is to dialogue with some up-to-date physicists with McLuhan in mind. I think that's what you were starting to say. Can you say that again?
Well, sure, but I don't want to come across as somebody who claims to understand modern physics. All I am interested in at the moment is trying to see how broadly conceived fundamental physics is in particular essays, and then try to critique them from a McLuhan point of view as being limited.
You said to me, you think it's very important to do that. And I was telling you how I attempted to do that with Jack Sarfatti. And,
yes, sir.
And now you're thinking of it. And it is something that if you have a good, deep understanding of McLuhan, you do come up to these questions about science and physics and how would they respond if you brought in a perspective that McLuhan had that does encompass matter and the changes in matter or changes or ideas of matter. Would any scientist, modern scientist, be interested? So that's what I tried to do with Jack. I made up a formula based on the Android meme and sent it to him about 1999, and he did not recognize any traditional mathematical terminology or formulaic letters, so he said, I don't know what to make of this. So he's just polite, basically probably just thought it was ridiculous. But you would support what I attempted to do there, to open up a dialogue. So tell me some more that you would say about that, if you can. How would you do it?
I think the fundamental thing is the question of whether the sort of stuff that McLuhan was doing could suggest new possibilities, either for experimentation or for theorization. And all that a person like me can do, I guess similar to what you were doing with Jack, is attempting to show how a particular formulation can be looked at in multiple ways, and suggesting that those multiple ways may be suggestive.
Yeah, like he said in Understanding Media or Gutenberg Galaxy, that modern physics was trying to visualize the non-visualizable. And that's a good statement to be in, because, you know, if the atom is in or the subatomic particles in two places at the same time, how do you visualize that? And then how does a formula, alphabetic-derived formula, do anything there? So it's a simple statement. I assume no physicist ever thought about it or cared that he said that or understood him, but would you begin with that kind of thinking?
No, that's a good example. But McLuhan also said that about philosophy, right? People from Hegel on were trying to visualize the acoustic. So if it seems to me that it should be interesting to physicists to think along the lines that you were just suggesting, that the ways in which people attempt to visualize things can be a useful exercise, but visualization is inherently limited. And so when McLuhan tried to think through the limits of visualization, it may be that he came up with potential ways of thinking about physical problems that could be fertile.
Yeah.
So I don't know enough about physics to know that they would be fertile. All I can do is suggest that possibility.
Yeah, now I had an idea just went through my head, I remember, but I can't get it right now. So you were about the visualization. Well, this is what it is. It's a quote, I think, in Explorations where he talks about, you know, at the time in the Renaissance, the model of the body was it was consisted of humors, right? You know what they are?
Yes, sir.
And then he says something like, and I keep thinking this is in his first essay, A Culture Without Literacy, in Volume 1. If you have that sitting there, you could look at that, see if it's in the first couple of paragraphs. So he goes through, the printed book comes in, and it changes the body image. And then I know the next one, probably in the industrial era, 19th century, it becomes a pumping machine. Okay, that's levers. You know, kinetic technology. So the body mm-hmm. becomes a pumping machine. And then as you get into the 20th century, it becomes a bag of chemicals.
Yeah.
Does that quote sound familiar? He goes through about four phases. And he
Yes, no, it does. It does sound familiar. I wouldn't be able to identify where it is. But you could be right that it's in the first Explorations essay.
Yeah, let me just see if I put a search, bag of chemicals. That was the. Let's just see if that brings up anything in my own computer. Bag of chemicals. No, it says bag of chemicals, but didn't go to anything. What's in this? Just a second. No, it didn't work. So the point is that it becomes a bag of chemicals, and that's the last image in science of the body, and that leads to drugs, and IG Farben and all that stuff in the teens and 20s.
Mm-hmm.
You know, chemical takes over as a model. But there's a body percept of what we're made up of, our physics, and it goes through changes due to the change in media. So part of the reason in my tiny note chart, if you look on it, I've got a column of subatomic particles, but beside them I have changes in disease. And they were what Carolyn discovered, starting in 79, for the next 15 years, there would become fads of ailments in the alternative medicine world, people who were trying to avoid drugs and surgery. So they, like the first one was maybe hypoglycemia, and then there's chronic fatigue, environmental allergies, immunity deficiencies. These were fads that would be on the cover of Time magazine about, you know, every 3 years from 79 mm-hmm. to early 90s. So they're the image of the stress factors in body problems changed. And, of course, there was such a rapidity of technologies in that period that the body image was always changing following McLuhan's suggestions, right? So as part of my Tino chart is the changes in disease or in new problems. You know, if you're discarnate all the time, electrified, disembodied, you might find the chemical body world irritating. So you start developing allergies. And it's psychosomatic due to the immediate effects. So I'm saying I apply that to chemistry, and you can apply it to physics because media affects nature or matter, and it's embedded in matter from our brain's point of view, say. So science has to consider the media constituents of the chemical elements that you go on about from 200 years ago. They got the chemical elements. They build a knowledge base with that. And then you're suggesting we should bring in the media elements as new parts of what we're made up of. And so physics is ignoring our new constituents, at least on the textbook level, right? College mm-hmm. textbook. They might be doing all kinds of avant-garde stuff at CERN or something. But the you follow what I'm saying? I'm saying what?
Well, I think I follow it, but I think I also differ a bit in that I'm thinking along the lines that all scientific theory, so all theory in modern physics, is itself media-driven.
Yeah.
So that says to me that if physicists became aware of the media through which they are thinking, which isn't just one thing, there's probably all sorts of different media takes within the physics community. But if physicists were to factor that in, they should be able to come up with new possibilities for either experiment or theory.
Yeah. After I did my chart in 95, I became the newest fad was called energy medicine. And many people thought they were an emanation of energy. And they get deflated in their energy, and they have to get something to boost their energy. But they just thought of energy. So as we got more ethereal, or doing more with less, or disembodied, or holiopathic, these terms I use, we didn't have a body percept by the year 2000. No visual frameworks were used anymore. That's why people were doing acupuncture and Rolfing and all these different things that stimulated energy. So we had become a node of energy, was the final body image I had when we were thinking of it. And that was the expression of life in the Internet. And then what happened to physics? Their visualization models fell apart. They got as far as the quantum, never really got anything stable there. Don't even know if they could. And maybe they knew they couldn't. So what comes up is string theory, which is based on acoustic space. So we've completely moved out of visualization, and we're moving into a tactile nodes of energy, but that would not become an art form, a rearview mirror content of a new ground right away. What would happen would be the acoustic phase after the retrieval of acoustics, say the radio effect. The acoustic effect would be what would shape physicists' thinking. So why did string theory become popular and something that the old scientists would say, this stuff's ridiculous. They don't have any experiments. They have no models of anything. They don't have any visual space is what they would the old guys would complain about. But the guy, I forget his name, he carried on having a certain authority in modern physics. And if you ever heard of this guy, Eric Weinstein, does that mean anything to you?
Yes.
Yeah. He's on a campaign, and maybe he would be interested in this. He's on a campaign to say that physics has become completely corrupt. And he's been interviewed on Joe Rogan and a few other places about this. Maybe you've seen them. But he runs through the various icons, including the string theory guy, and you know he says there's something fraudulently going on there. He doesn't know it, but he's ready to see there needs to. He says we got to do something new. It's not working anymore. That's right, our time to enter, right? And tell Eric this is what you're looking for. So, but I thought it was nice and cute that they are doing acoustic space because it's been so lodged in us with our musical. We live entirely by music today, as McLuhan said, that is the main means of knowing for people. They live tactile in the chip body, but their anchor is acoustic space. So physics adapts, and it's called string theory. They describe it as an acoustic kind of stuff. I don't know. Did you know that?
No.
Yeah, it's not visualizable, what they're doing, which bugs the quantum.
Oh, for sure it's not visualizable. It's n-dimensional.
Yeah. So We're making progress here. Let's see.
Oh, I think so.
What?
McLuhan's main point from the very beginning was that you never can understand one of these modes of experience without understanding them all.
Yeah.
Right? So it's a little bit like saying, well, can I understand salt if I don't understand sugar? And the answer is no, you can't. Because in order to really understand salt, you have to understand chemistry. And once you understand chemistry, you can understand sugar. And it's the same thing with acoustic and visual space. If you are only thinking in acoustic space, you don't understand acoustic space.
Right. Yeah, you have to juxtapose the ratios and parallel images, sensory structures. So
yeah.
That was McLuhan's secret agenda. He applied it. He said James Joyce's discoveries are way more important than Einstein's. You remember that sentence?
Yeah. And he said that his own discoveries were more important than DNA.
Right. And they both happened the same year, 53. You ever notice that pattern? He gets the grant and gets explorations going in 53.
Yeah.
And that's when he was ready to go public and put the world on. And that's the same year for DNA discovery, like Crick and Watson. So that's interesting, 53.
Yeah.
And it's also symbolized by Stalin dying. That changed the politics of the world. And there's a lot of other stuff that happened in 53.
Sure. So, for example, Bob, that's when Hans Selye published an essay in Explorations. That was in Explorations number one.
Yeah, the stress theory.
And yeah, so in McLuhan's essay on stress in Explorations 8, he has the following to say. He says, the Greek view of the body as package of organs.
You found it. That's it.
At the Renaissance to a view of
I interrupted. Start again. It's a very important quote.
The Greek view of the body as package of organs and humors got cut down at the Renaissance to a view of the body as a pumping station. Then with the rise of chemistry in the 19th century, the body became a chemistry factory. Everybody was loaded with germs. But the rise of field theory in physics now has its medical counterpart in Dr. Hans Selye's breath view.
Holy shit, I forgot about that as the punchline, the fourth phase, or the modern phase. That's pretty amazing. So what, did you suddenly remember what I was thinking of, or you just started looking at it? How'd you find it?
No, I found it by looking for humors, and I had to use humor with both the Canadian and the American spelling, and then I got it.
So you had that quote in your files?
Yes.
Awesome. You're not even looking at the book.
No, I'm looking at the little essay on stress.
But see, that's a really important quote. That shows you the figure of ground of what we're talking about, that it would apply to physics and any science.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So in Selye's work, as quoted by McLuhan, what happens is you have pre-existent possibilities, and then the body kind of play.
Kind of what? Uh-oh.
His notion of consciousness.
Blipped out. Cameron, you've blipped out. I missed the last 15 seconds, so say that again.
Oh, sorry. I don't think I changed the phone, but I may have. What I was saying is that McLuhan's view of consciousness is either taken from Selye or at least is consonant with Selye.
Yeah.
Because both start with pre-existing structures, and then they understand what they're looking at. In Selye's case, it's the health of the body. And in McLuhan's case, it's understanding media.
Well, the health of the body politic.
Yes. Both but both of them stress that there are pre-existent structures.
Yeah. Would that be effects preceding causes?
Pre-existing structures necessarily have effects.
Yeah.
And the way that human beings operate is that they nearly always deal with effects, not knowing that they are effects.
Yeah.
And the great revolutions in thought happens when somebody exercises pattern recognition and they say, wait a minute, these effects that we've already seen actually came from a cause which we haven't seen yet.
Yeah. Good. So the stress thing, oh, yeah. So by the 80s, it was a big fad of being a stress coach.
Absolutely.
You know, a lot of people were under stress. That was the beginning of becoming an energy node. But they were coming out of the chemical body image, and they were moving discarnately, and now they were a bundle of stresses, which was really just McLuhan's ratios. And a lot of people had stress. A lot of people quit their jobs because they had stress. I don't have stress on the chart, but stress is like more general, not the mm-hmm. particular chronic fatigue or environmental allergies, but they come from stress. So
yeah. Stress is actually another word for medium.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a dynamic symmetry of tensions among proportions. Isn't that
right.
phrase?
Yeah.
Dynamic symmetry of tensions among proportions. And that's the definition of life, of your being.
Yep.
So the so we're talking about changes in the body image, changes in matter image. What about out in space? You know, quasars and whatever they got out there. What mm-hmm. was the evolution of imagery that the astronomers came up with over the last 100 years? I wonder if you could map that onto different media phases.
Oh, definitely, definitely. So one thing that's very interesting is the whole question of black holes.
Yeah.
And everybody's interested in black holes. Everybody knows that there's something about black holes that have to do with their own life and with their own destiny and all this sort of stuff.
Yeah.
But black holes are structural elements in the universe that cannot be brought into any single field. They fall between fields.
Yeah.
And that is very much of a McLuhan idea that the you could say the medium of media is a black hole.
Yeah. Now, would you know what the color of tactility is?
As the McLuhan color of tactility?
Yeah.
Well, one color he suggests is black.
That's right. Black. And, of course, we're in the global theater. You know, there's intervals everywhere. Intervals become dominant. And the astronomers projected that into space as black holes, black tactility.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then it became dark matter. Same thing.
Yeah,
it's
dark
talking
energy.
About the extension of tactility.
Yeah.
So I forgot that. You know, when I was thinking, what are the astronomical things? I forgot about you brought up black holes. And oh, yeah, the black of tactility. So I remember thinking that. Yeah, so you got that covered. Now, what else is, what other knowledge bases are there? Is weather, how they judge weather, climate or climate change? That's
yeah.
just the shifting of the environments that we become aware of in our Android meme quantum fluctuations.
Sure.
Everybody knows that the only constant today is change. So,
yes, well, climate change is just one example of pollution.
Yeah.
And pollution, according to McLuhan's ideas, arose through satellite technology, where we had an opportunity to look back on the Earth as a whole.
Right. And then pollution are rear-view mirror disservices. There may be services in it that we don't see. You know, you're projecting old images of nature to think it's a disaster. So we could maybe relax about climate change, applying McLuhan to where that fad of perception came from. So what's we're talking about? Fads of perception that come out of the general media that's in use, and then it ripples across the board in all forms of knowledge, in all categories, and in business and everything, and everybody is doing the same. They're all talking black holes, like you just said.
Yeah, and of course, one of McLuhan's great interests in the 50s was art theory.
Yes.
Art theory applies to all this because starting in the 19th century, instead of people looking at individual styles, they started to look at the question of plural styles. And that's really what we're looking at. If we're looking at the different images that succeed one another and compete with one another in the different disciplines, what we're really talking about is the whole question of style.
Yeah.
In all of these disciplines, and what the question of style can suggest about everything, right? And McLuhan's great contribution to the question of style is that all styles can be formulated in terms of their middles, that is to say, in terms of their media. So media theory is the question of a general theory of styles, you could say.
Right. So what did you mean by plural style in the 19th century? Plural theory?
Yeah,
or something?
So people became aware that as there was speed up and as the world came to be consolidated into highly confused front pages, you could say, it became obvious to everybody that the question of style was not a question of what is the best style or what style should we have. They had to consider styles plural.
Right.
They had to consider the fact that there were all sorts of different styles.
Yeah, relativity of styles.
Correct. And this led to a whole new anthropology where people would look at primitive cultures not as something that we need to look at chronologically, as something that has only been surpassed. We need to look at them as a style of cognition, a style of being in the world.
Yeah.
Right?
A style of stress, perceptual stress.
Yeah, absolutely.
So,
absolutely.
So listen to this. So I'm reading a lot of Wyndham Lewis, and he is the figure of this. He went through so many he didn't join the movements, but he studied every art movement, like starting off with Impressionism and then Cubism and then Expressionism and then Futurism was in there.
Surrealism.
Surrealism and Dada and whatever else. And he would, you know, starting in the teens, he would become aware of these things because he got kicked out of Slade School in 1901. So he spent the next 7 years wandering around Europe and became aware of all these art things that were just starting, the beginning of, you know, modernism, I guess you would call it. And his buddies back in school, they didn't know about this stuff. So he came back to London in late 1908, and he started to write a novel about art, his experience in these cities. So it's based in Paris. It's called Tar, and it's the interplay of a German artist, an English artist based on him, and he's Tar, and then a Russian female artist and maybe a French artist and someone else. And the book didn't come out till after World War One, about 1918, you know, at the end there. And but then as people were reading it in the 20s, they said, oh, this is a metaphor for the European countries interacting with each other before World War One and the tensions between them. And he had anthropomorphized it into these artists. Yeah. So he begins by studying the artist. That's his portrait of the artist as a young man, which comes out like 2 years after Joyce's, and Joyce's portrait is in 1916. So from that point on, because he had a head start in all the art movements, he was ready for any changes that happened in Europe. So he marred them all, and he would react to them. And Blast was, in 1914, a reaction. But you track him through the 20s and 30s and 40s, he's analyzing philosophy, trends, all kinds of things. But one of the main things is art theory, and you get to see what the art theory was if you read Lewis on many books by him, and he'll be dealing with an art theory, and then he'll give its bias, and then his position, his bias or counter-environment. So as you were talking, I was thinking Lewis was the first to do this in art theory. There were enough changes. I mean, in the 19th century, there weren't that many changes, but there were enough changes, and he was tracking the stresses of it, and therefore he's a major figure in the foundation of media ecology. And he did it through art theory. He showed the changes. And he kept adapting, adjusting, reacting, and so people thought, well, this guy, he jumped all over the place. Like, what was he about? And they can't figure out what his opinion was. And McLuhan wrote a review of Lewis in Renaissance, I think, in the 50s, saying that you have to understand that Lewis didn't have a point of view. He was just reacting with whatever new perceptions he could have to what was happening around him, to the stresses in the art world. So Wyndham Lewis, right now, I'm reading Lewis, so it's prominent in my head, reading a lot of his books, and he's doing what you were just saying, looking at the plurality of style that was happening and trying to find the causes.
Yeah, and he was doing it in literature.
Yeah.
Maybe his painting could be related. I don't know enough about
his painting. His painting, but, they were parallel. His painting was a translation of his novels and or books, and his books were a translation of his painting. They were totally interpenetrating.
Have you looked into the difference between the different editions of Tar?
No, I have not read the later version, 1928, and I haven't read the later version of Enemy of the Stars. No, I haven't done those. I'm just doing them for the first time.
But I wanted to point out that there was a lot of work going on, especially in Europe, on theory of styles. So,
well, that was a new trend, right? So there's so many.
Yeah.
Because there was change, people started to look at this, have a figure ground perspective. And so Marxist guys were doing it, you know, conservative thinkers were doing it, the whole range were doing the same thing. So McLuhan would say, well, Lewis was a figure for the British critics, and name all the guys around Europe. They're all reacting to radio and movies, automobiles. That media mix made culture as our business happen faster and turn over faster. So they were forced to have a more detached perspective.
Just by being alive.
Yeah.
One of his interesting suggestions is that the effect of being alive as new things are invented comes way before the any idea of where those effects come from. But just by being alive in 1910, let's say, you have to be aware of cars for the first time.
Yeah.
And because you don't want to be hit by them, or you notice the changes that they're making to the city, et cetera, et cetera. And so that drives a change in consciousness that revolves around a new consciousness of change itself.
Yeah.
Right? That's sort of McLuhan's reading of modern times right there.
Yeah, he had a theory of transformation, not transportation. The changes, people get to the point, you know, by the 70s or 80s, the cliche was the only cost in our lives is change. So that's what everybody is used to. But Joyce and them, and there's a very good McLuhan student named Vincent Sherry. Have I ever mentioned him to you?
You may have. The name is familiar to me. He was a literary scholar, wouldn't he?
Yes, and he was a student of McLuhan, but he he taught in Pennsylvania or someplace, and he's written a lot of books about 1914 period. He did one on Pound and Lewis and radical modernism. But he did a book on World War One and the shock to Eliot and Joyce and everybody as the British government trying to justify this ridiculous warfare in the trenches and create meaning for the population. They had to, quote, lie all the time. They had to change their policies or change their opinions. And no one had witnessed a government changing themselves so much over that four-year period that it looked corrupt. And so his thesis is that Eliot, Pound, you know, the men of 1914, were so influenced and noticed these changes that it changed their art. So they brought in change as a part of their art more, like in Ulysses or in Finnegan's Wake or in the Cantos or in Lewis's writing and Eliot. They are registering the new confusion caused by the rapidity of World War One, which was really not what was going on in the trenches. The real war was the software war of authorities trying to keep in charge and define as if there's a purpose to that hardware war. You know what I mean? The real war was software war in World War One.
And that story is still going on today in spades.
Yep. No, in the extremists.
Especially in England.
Yeah, in the establishment.
Ludicrous.
So Vincent lays out, he shows you the positions of the governor, the prime minister, 10 Downing Street, you know, what they said in 1914, how they had different stuff in 15 and then changed again in 16. And this is a serious thing. People are supposed to be in a hardware war and there are people dying. And the government doesn't even know, you can't figure out why they're doing it. Why are we doing this? Because the government had to change with all the rapid changes that were multi-changing and pluralizing right in front of everybody. So the revolution in culture really happened in World War One. That's when these guys like Joyce changed Ulysses halfway through the war, partly influenced by Lewis's theater called Enemy of the Stars, which was in Blast. That was a most radical, a crazy, extreme form of theater that nobody knew how to produce, how to make it theater. They couldn't visualize it. But it became a model for Waiting for Godot and all kinds of things. A lot of people were influenced by that part of Blast, what he did. But he was anticipating the hallucinatory quality of changes that were going to happen to the public from 1914 to 1918.
Yep.
So there's your stress theory. So I'm responding to what you said. You said there's change, becoming aware of change. What were you saying there? I think you finished it, but that's what I was responding to, that Vincent Cherry, a student of McLuhan, he learned something from McLuhan. He applied it to the 1914 era.
Yeah.
So what? So you were saying people became aware of change more and more due to technologies. In many ways, McLuhan was writing a description of how people were living. Everybody was going through these media changes that he has in different chapters in Understanding Media. Everybody was being an instinctive media ecologist.
Correct. Just to be alive.
Yeah, there it is. Yeah, just to be alive is what you started off saying. You had to become a media ecologist. And very crude. And you see that Lewis stands out. He was a little more on top of it than even Joyce and Pound and Eliot. And so he confused people. And he got, you know, considered to be a very antisocial person because he would be honest about the changes that were happening. So you get to that famous line I've told you many times. In 1929, he says, I'm part fascist, part communist, a Marxist with morals, and an anarchist
Royalist
with a healthy passion for order.
Yeah.
That's a perfect description of what was happening to the citizen, though they would not understand that. One of the symptoms is, McLuhan said, people, by 1910, they thought they needed an audience. More, that's the audience participating, and they've got all kinds of new thoughts and emotions So they need an audience. So they went to this guy who provided a couch you'd lie on, and you would talk, and you had an audience, the psychiatrist. That was the popularity of Freud, was due to people needing an audience. They never did that before. So that's mediaecology. McLuhan was always photographed lying on the couch.
That's right.
Yeah, on purpose.
I'm inclined to say here that Lewis himself never got entirely comfortable with what he could see.
That's right.
Right. He had a very difficult personality. But McLuhan, you could say, is the guy who saw what Lewis saw and didn't let it bother him.
He completed Lewis. And so in the Wyndham Lewis Society that I'm part of, I told you, monthly reading group. We do Lewis's books. And that's partly why I'm reading Lewis now, for this group. The two main guys, I do it, or no one else does, but if McLuhan gets hinted at, then these two guys who started, they were the first guys to do a PhDs on McLuhan, on Lewis in the late 60s, early 70s, and they're real authorities on Lewis now. If McLuhan comes up, they go, yeah, here's an idea that McLuhan ripped off Lewis. Every time, whatever new idea, and then I started pointing things out, and they say, yeah, McLuhan ripped off Lewis on that one. They haven't read enough McLuhan to see the vast vistas of McLuhan, way beyond Lewis. But it came from Lewis, as Marshall said, but he completed it. He made it more unemotional. It was like done. What Lewis was struggling in, McLuhan came and picked up the corpses and picked up the pieces and of Lewis's brain and redid it again more comprehensively. But they cannot see that. I'm not allowed to bring up McLuhan very much before they start saying, come on. McLuhan, he did Lewis badly, they say.
Yeah.
So it's a pretty interesting little drama where I'm sitting there and they know my life with McLuhan, and they wait for me to say something, but I'm cagey. I don't say nothing until they're not ready. Or when they're not there, sometimes they miss a meeting, and they're not there, then I'll lay it all out, and then the people report, well, Bob was telling us all this great stuff, and you missed it all. So it's a matter of sneaking it in, you know? So that's, I'm doing mediaecology right there with the group, with the McLuhan ecology. I'm careful how I bring it up because I don't want to get kicked out. And so I agree completely what you said about Lewis and McLuhan. McLuhan, he even explains in that essay in The Electric Light, 1959, he's talking to his community, the Basilians, and he talks about how Lewis was a cool writer, but he was up against Protestant majority in the 20s and 30s, and he couldn't harness the Protestant fury. He couldn't be hot enough, so it never worked. Then McLuhan recognized, well, the world has flipped. It's not hot anymore. It's cool in the 60s, thanks to TV. So then he said, now's the time to do Lewis and be cool, right? So he acted out Lewis coolly without all the animosity Lewis suffered.
Yeah.
It was the right time to do Lewis. And he does say in this article in Atlantic Monthly in December 69, he ends by saying, you know, Lewis is an artist, a giant, whose carapace of art forms we can admire today. But he, and then he also says, bless the student. What a lucky person if he discovers Lewis. But there was another point. Oh, yeah, he says that that Lewis's art it has the qualities, his painting, of the cool effect of television. It's a cool art. And I don't think I've read different, critics on Lewis's art. They don't know that. They don't know that he was expressing TV sensibility in his art. TV wasn't even around when he was happening. But it's a pretty good statement by Marshall, that the cool, tactile qualities. Now, he once wrote to Sheila Watson in the mid-60s. He had a big insight. He probably called her up and woke her up. And he said, I just realized that Lewis, when he's talking about the values of the eye versus the acoustic values of time, you know, space versus time. And he was a space guy, which he called eye and E-Y-E. And McLuhan said, I just realized that what he called eye, he thought it was visual, but he was actually describing the eye as tactile, the tactile eye. Did you remember that letter? Have you seen it?
Vaguely.
It's really important.
And it's an important, oh, yeah, it's very important.
Yeah, he pointed out, he realized that, you know, let's say by 1965, thinking about Sheila Watson's PhD on Lewis, that happened in 65, and he said, hey, here, I just realized this, focusing on Lewis, that he was talking about tactility in visual space or through the eye, and then that's why 4 years later in 69, he says that he's matured the insight and said, yeah, Lewis was a TV artist. He was cool,
yeah.
Tactile
so
eye.
What's going on in McLuhan's mind, I think, is that in 1960, he thought that the acoustic was the ground of things.
Yes.
And he had to learn in the 1960s that the acoustic and the visual needed to be thought together via tactility.
Yeah.
And so what he's seeing in Lewis is what he himself had to learn.
That's right. He was projecting what he was discovering. And then
correct.
Since he got so much of it from Lewis, he had to go back to see, well, what did Lewis get it? Remember how he and Eric, they said they get an insight and then they go check Fitting's Wake to see if it's in there, and they often found it in there? Well, he had
yep.
to check with Lewis because that was his personal mentor sort of thing on one level. So he, yeah, he had to go back and change what Lewis had discovered.
Yeah. So for our conversation and for your own conversations with the Lewis people.
Yeah.
Let me just read you a couple sentences from the Project 69.
Okay.
So this would have been written in 1959 probably, and then was part of the project when it was submitted in 1960. So he says, in 1915, Heinrich Wolfflin published his Principles of Art History, which has since then revolutionized the study of many matters besides art. This entire approach confirms what I discovered about media. The effect of the thing is what counts, not the sensuous facts. Switching attention to effects away from the sensuous facts highlighted that the visual is in effect very tactile, resonant, and auditory.
Wow.
So that's an amazing statement in 1960.
Right.
And,
in other words, he tells Sheila he discovers about Lewis, you know, in 65 or so, but no, he discovered it 8 years before secretly.
Right. But notice that before you were talking about the importance of the year 1915.
Yes.
You were talking about the importance of it for Lewis, for Joyce.
And for Wolfflin.
Yeah, and Wolfflin, what was he doing in the Principles of Art History? He was looking at styles. He was looking at dominance within art history and trying to understand how the dominance worked with each other.
Yeah.
And Wolfflin was the professor, the mentor of Gideon.
That's right.
And Gideon was met by McLuhan in the same year that he met Lewis. So the whole of the decade of the 1940s was dominated for McLuhan trying to think through Lewis and Gideon together.
Right. Now, well, who's the guy who the art critic who did the Problem of Form back then at the time of Wolfflin?
Yeah, that was at the right around the turn of the century.
Yeah, another famous name.
Yeah, of course, we can't think of it right now.
Yeah.
I think it starts with H. Oh, Hildebrand.
Yeah, Hildebrand. Okay, yeah. So just the last week in the latest meeting, I was going to bring up this point about the discovery of tactility by art criticism, and I couldn't remember whether it was Wolflin or the other guy. So yeah. I held back because I didn't want to say the wrong critic because someone there might have known.
And, it was Hildebrand.
Yeah, so now I'll next time present it because I got it clarified with your help here. Yeah, that Wolflin point. And also Berenson says something back then. He says some... looking for the tactile aspects of retinal impressions. Do you know that quote?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's right at the end of one of his essays, and McLuhan quotes it somewhere.
Yeah, and that's another guy discovering this tactile factor. The word had a bit of vogue in the teens, I guess, right?
Yes. Yeah, or even earlier.
Yeah. With and Hildebrand. Then, he has a chapter, I think he even has the word tactile in the chapter titles.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, Berenson, Wolflin, and Hildebrand are important. And now, why did we bring this? Oh yeah, so the tactile eye. And so I didn't notice that quote that you're quoting there. That's really, what page is that in Project 69?
You know, I don't even know the section it's in. I oftentimes in the blog, what I do is I just mention the overall title. Because I don't want people just to mine the quotation. Mm-hmm. I want them to look up the whole essay or the whole book.
Ah.
And so here I don't document where it comes from. I can look it up, though, and in the course of our conversation I'll let you know.
Right. And what? When did you quote it? How recently? In your blog?
Well, I probably quoted a number of times, but this particular blog was written in February 2018.
Right. Now, I'm talking about the Sheila Watson letter. I think it's in the book. Do you remember it?
In the book, you mean letters?
Yeah, where he talks about his discovery,
sure.
Tactile eye. So you already knew about that and knew this previous quote from 1960.
Yes, but
nobody's ever talked to you about it.
I can't keep all these things in mind at the same time. That's why I have to record it in the blog, and then I can forget about it.
We've never discussed that, the tactile eye, I don't think.
Yeah. So here's a quote for you from Inside the Five Sense Sensorium.
Yeah, I know that
1961.
Yes.
The art historian Heinrich Wolflin taught the Hildebrand stress on visual forms as haptic or tangible tactile.
Wow. But what is it? I thought you said he taught it. Read the sentence again.
Yeah, the art historian Heinrich Wolflin taught the Hildebrand stress on visual forms as haptic or tangible tactile. And Wolflin's pupil, Siegfried Gideon, embodied it in his space, time, and architecture.
Wow. There's a really important chain there. Hildebrand, he taught Wolflin?
No, they were contemporaries.
Oh, okay. But Hildebrand got there first?
In terms of tactility, perhaps.
Yeah.
But I think for McLuhan, the central influence is Gideon.
Yes.
And then Gideon goes back to these other figures.
So you got, for those listening, here's the sequence, very important. Hildebrand, Wolflin, Gideon, Hildebrand, Wolflin, Berenson, Gideon, Carpenter. There's the history of McLuhan's deepening understanding of tactility. Those are the five figures. Carpenter coming out with the Eskimo stuff, right?
Yeah. Well, I think so. I think probably there are other figures that contributed.
Berenson, what's the guy, his best buddy in 39 in St. Louis?
Muller Team.
Yeah, he was he expressed Thomistic tactility or something to Marshall, right? I think he
definitely.
So we have to put him in there.
Yes,
he might be before Gideon.
Oh, he was before Gideon.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, before in McLuhan time.
Yes.
The space time and architecture was a series of lectures at Harvard in 1938. So before McLuhan and Muller team ever met, Gideon had already set out these ideas.
Right. But McLuhan meets it later. So this is a new chain of influence no one's ever said before. Hildebrand, Wolfflin, Berenson, for McLuhan, Muller, Tim, then Gideon, then Carpenter. Six
yeah.
names.
And those are this is roughly parallel to Lewis.
Oh, and then there's Lewis in there, for freak's sake. Yeah. But Lewis was probably confusing for McLuhan because he didn't talk about tactility as far as we know. You know, he didn't use that term, or he didn't know he was tactile. That was McLuhan's point to Sheila. He didn't recognize the tactile qualities, and he thought it was visual. But he had a tactile view of it. And then he lived a tactile life of always dealing with the new stresses and the basic changes going on. He was a very tactile person, Lewis was.
Right. But McLuhan's criticism of Lewis that he makes in his 53 essay that Lewis liked, but there's a criticism in there of Lewis that his theorizing of his own work was screwed up. That in his theory, he was too visual, although in his practice, he was tactile.
Yeah, so he intuited that in 53 or so when he wrote that. Then he got it more crystalline by 1960, and then he was able to say it sure to Sheila Watson in 65. That would be the progression there. Yeah, mm-hmm. So he caught on to it real early. But that's because he's with these other guys.
Yes.
So it's seven names now. We're going to add in Lewis in there after Gideon and before Carpenter.
Well, he meets Gideon and Lewis the same year, and he begins to read the two of them in parallel.
Yeah.
Right? So he's reading Space, Time, and Architecture and all sorts of small essays by Gideon, but at the same time, he's reading The Art of Being Ruled and...
And talking to Lewis.
That's right. Of course, talking with Lewis for sure, and talking to Gideon.
Yeah.
Right? So there are letters between McLuhan and Gideon at that time, and it's Gideon who tells him that if he wants to come clear about the stuff that he's thinking about, he has to get into French poetry.
Mm.
So what does McLuhan do in the later 1940s is he starts relearning his French and reading Mallarmé.
Right.
And Baudelaire and Rimbaud and all these guys. So
Gideon
threads.
Told him that.
Yeah.
And who is Gideon? Gideon buries James Joyce.
Well, yeah, his wife was a good friend of Joyce. Gideon, I think, was in America when Joyce died and couldn't get back to Europe because of the war.
Okay, because Gideon, Joyce, the only guy that he talked to the deeper meanings of Finney's Wake was with Gideon. And I talked to Joyce through the Evergreens, using the medium, about their relationship. And Joyce said that, yeah, Gideon was the only guy who understood me, you know, even more than Frank Budgen. And he was the last guy that Joyce would talk about, whenever 39, 41, 40, he dies in January 41. So, and you know, he moves to Switzerland and the Gideons are there, but we don't know when Siegfried wasn't there, but you're saying he wasn't there in January 41. So his wife buried Joyce. But the conversation,
right.
you have Joyce talking deeper stuff about what he was really doing that the literati didn't know. The transition people didn't know, you know, Jolas and those guys, but it's transmitted to Gideon. Then Gideon makes a book called Space, Time, and Architecture. And does that come out? I thought it was 41. Would you know when it came out? 39, 40?
Yeah, it is 41.
Yeah, and so there's the space time dialectic that Lewis did, and architecture, and that's what Lewis first began his meteorology with Caleb's design in 19. 1919 he wrote that book. But look at that. Within 2 years of Joyce being with Gideon, he's with McLuhan. It's that close. It's that quick, the transition or the passing on the knowledge.
Yep.
No, it's pretty incredible. And I've told you that on September 1st, when World War II broke out, I think it was September 1st, McLuhan is in Paris on his honeymoon. He hears about the war breaking out, so he grabs Corinne and they go for the wherever the boat is to get across the channel. And while he's up there, you know, starting to go across the channel in his boat, down the channel comes Wyndham Lewis, who's on a big liner. And James Joyce is right there on the channel, too, on the coast at his daughter's hospital, where, you know, where she was being looked after. So you had this triangle of McLuhan, Joyce, and Lewis, all within proximity of each other in that little area, northern France, on the coast of the water, right when the war breaks out. And so the war is what McLuhan acted out in trying to figure out whether he was a Lewisian or a Joycean that Don Thiel writes a lot about, trying to resolve the antinomy between those two guys. And so he says in Interior Landscape, I don't know if it's in the Lewis essay, but it might be in the Joyce one, he says that Joyce had a little more humor than Lewis. You remember that sentence?
Sure.
Yeah. And so, but McLuhan will say he got it from Lewis. And he said he was Lewis's first to do the media en bloc. But that's the struggle. Lewis was the first to see it, like to go into the silent sea and then had go through all the psychic pressure of seeing that stuff and not knowing what he's seeing, not being able to articulate it. Because you can see in his books, he's recognizing that technologies, the press, media, are a big stress factor in what's going on. But he doesn't lay it out so clearly as McLuhan does.
Well, see, to me, the influence of Lewis on McLuhan is that Lewis sees what needs to be explained.
Yeah.
And I think that's very close to your heart. I think that's sort of what you like to do, is find things that can be regarded as a problem, and then within the problem, there'll be the solution.
Right.
And that's certainly an important part of McLuhan. But I think what he gets from Gideon is a way of explaining that Lewis never had.
That's right.
So Lewis helps McLuhan understand what the problems are.
Yeah.
And Gideon helps McLuhan see how there might be a solution there. So it's from Gideon that McLuhan gets the whole idea of the symphony.
Right.
McLuhan, the whole rest of his life, talked about how we need to see the symphony of the senses, or the symphony of the media. We need to see the plurality in order to see the singularity.
And when you say it like that, I hear Joyce, because Joyce is in The Phoenix Wake emphasizing the senses and the extensions. So that's the kind of stuff I'm sure they talked about. And Gideon did his version. He explained Finnegan's Wake with space-time architecture.
Yeah, that I can't speak to. I don't know that that's...
You don't know Finnegan's Wake enough, you're saying?
Exactly.
I see. So I had another point there. You were saying that Gideon... what's interesting is Drucker, you know, the great... consultant of the corporations later, he experiences McLuhan talking in 41 or so, 40-41, and he tells a story that McLuhan didn't have the phrase "the medium is the message," but later when that came out, he realized that that's what McLuhan was saying in 41 when he saw him speak. So Drucker is lurking in there to exploit this new view himself as a consultant.
Correct. And this is actually a very interesting topic for McLuhan. What we see here is something that's very unusual in North American intellectual history, and especially in Canadian intellectual history. And that is that McLuhan had exposure, personal exposure, to a whole series of European intellectuals. And those intellectuals appreciated McLuhan's mind and tried to teach McLuhan more or less as an individual student. But these are things which almost never happen to intellectuals at that time in North America. Later,
right.
People began to look into Derrida and all of these, and Heidegger and all this sort of stuff. But in the 1930s and 1940s, when McLuhan was meeting all these people personally, right, and
yep.
Being influenced by them, I mean, just think, he meets Drucker. And by the way, Drucker was in Detroit when McLuhan was in Windsor. So Drucker is, not only is he a European that is one more European that influences McLuhan, he's also one more Detroit guy at a time when Lewis was in Windsor.
Yeah.
McLuhan was in Windsor, and Drucker was in Detroit.
Wow, that's another triangulation, like I was describing with the English Channel, right there in Detroit.
Yeah.
Windsor.
In a couple of years, McLuhan will meet Jill Sohn in Toronto. He'll be a colleague of Jill Sohn. So you have all of these people like Drucker, Lewis, Gideon, there's more, Jill Sohn. There's five or six of these
Maritain.
Guys. Are, yeah, well, I don't know that McLuhan
met him.
Ever had a personal relationship with Maritain, but his good friend Phelan, right, the Catholic priest who basically brought him into the
church
and was, they were very close friends and corresponded with each other and knew each other very well. Phelan was a translator and a close friend of both Maritain and Jill Sohn.
Mm.
And so you could say that through Phelan, who had been, Phelan was educated in Europe. So through Phelan, that was another sort of avenue he had to European culture. And this connection with European culture, not American culture, not Canadian culture, is very distinctive of McLuhan, and it's almost not appreciated at all.
Yeah, and so here's the pattern I hadn't thought of before. Lewis, 1901 to 1908, he's in Europe experiencing stuff that his peers in London aren't getting. McLuhan redid Lewis in the same levels of going beyond his provincial beginnings and exploring beyond what anybody else in his peer group didn't have. He redid what Lewis did in terms of getting out of his local town, his local culture.
Yeah. But you see, did you just say the local pound?
No, the local town. Yeah, local town, T-O-W-N.
Okay. But it's important for us to mention that at the end of the period you're talking about, so around 1908, is when Pound and Lewis come together.
Yeah.
And then in the 1940s, when McLuhan meets Lewis and then rereads Time and Western Man and reads for the first time stuff like The Art of Being Ruled, he's also reading Pound.
Yeah, you have to put Pound
to meet
in
Pound.
There. You have to put
That's
Pound
right.
in there in the late 40s, early 50s. There's a whole dialogue with him.
Correct.
So he's meeting all the right people, which is what I try to show in my chart. I think that LaRouche, May Brussel, Zappa, McLuhan, William Irwin Thompson, Krishnamurti, Dr. Beter, Garrett Dean, those people in my life are special like that. And they're all important, and they have impact. So my chart has those guys in, and we're going through McLuhan's chart and who he had in his influential impact. Same bunch of amazing people. Let's see. Every one of the people in my chart are tactile artists. And McLuhan is meeting a lot of people who are touching on tactility in different ways, especially Pound and Joyce and Lewis. Well, he didn't meet Joyce, but he's studying. So this is the major discovery in culture is tactility in the 20th century because of the electric tactile extension. There's the big view. So McLuhan looked across all these fields, including all these giants he met, but they're all subject to the tactile electric effect. And that's the big level McLuhan is talking on. So he goes beyond science and culture to a new level of material causality, which is
I don't know that the word beyond is the right word there.
Well, it's bigger.
It's
bigger. I mean, you've got scholars spending all their life doing the wake or the cantos, and they specialize in one of these artists. McLuhan is looking at the artists and the scientists and sociologists and everybody in the world of knowledge, and he's at the center of it, center of culture and technology, and he's seeing a hidden ground that none of them saw. You know,
correct. Lewis. That is correct. But my objection is, imagine that somebody is looking at chemistry in the 19th century, and they say that, Mendeleev's table goes beyond all physical things. Well, no, I mean, in a sense, it goes beyond all physical things, but only in the sense that chemistry identifies what was always going on in those physical things, but not realized. So the same thing with McLuhan. If he can be said to go beyond art and culture generally, it's only because he's identifying what's already there.
Right, but he...
So it's beyond in a funny sense.
Well, it's a bigger perspective. It's a, just to say, okay, in 1895, I see the electric technologies come in, and I'm McLuhan, or as a Nostradamus, and I say, all these things will happen in books and painting and all the changes in science and the metaphors they use will be due to the electric technology. And then he could have said, I'm turning them off. We're not going to have a 20th century electric environment, and none of the 20th century would have happened as we know it. So what do you call that? It's a view of the crucible. It's like an extraterrestrial looking at the planet and saying, okay, they're turning on electricity. Tesla and these guys, who was it? Tesla was there at Niagara, right, when they brought in AC,
yep,
DC and all that stuff. That was the beginning of it. They turned it on. And an alien could have said, no, this is not good for the human, so he would have turned it off. That's a big. You're Archimedes. You found a place to lever the planet, to move the planet.
Mm-hmm. We agree with that. Where we disagree is the relationship between the theory and the practice. I see the two of them as linked by tactility, and therefore I never can see the one without the other.
Well, the same would apply to me, but I got to use categories to a literate American like you. I could just blabble here or sing you a song. which we do on the radio, but the I don't see there's much difference, just the way we're talking, because you're going to say your words, and then I'll try to say some words that complement it, and it might sound erroneous.
If I try to identify a difference, that doesn't mean that it's necessarily disharmonious or something.
Oh, okay.
Right.
Okay, but I'm not sure why you're making the distinction, other than it needs to be said because the average mind listening will make those.
You were talking about the reason I made the distinction is that you were talking about, well, I'm going to turn off electricity and then 20th century won't happen and stuff. We always disagree at what level McLuhan was advocating
influence,
sort of being the control tower.
Yeah, right.
And you tend to see it in terms of whole technologies, the thermostat or electricity or something like that.
Yeah.
And I see it in terms of structures and minute structures.
Yeah, you know he couldn't get away with that. I projected, well, he might have got away with it if he headed up the United Nations. But it just goes back to him saying that in Playboy magazine, you know.
Yeah.
He remember those pictures in 64 of the Center for Cultural Technologies, this awesome building where he's going to be studying sensing thresholds by computer. He was trying to go that way.
Yeah, he was being misguided by colleagues.
By Capon?
That was a ridiculous waste of time. But, I mean, he was trying to communicate his ideas, and he got derailed into...
By Capon.
Yeah, some sort of quantitative proof of his stuff.
Yeah, that's for listeners, that's C-A-P-P-O-N. He was a scientist, a York University guy, I think, who offered the McLuhan, the computer models for measuring sensory thresholds, which later McLuhan found out he was misusing their funds or something. You know, he's a bit of a thief. And so we never heard of Capon again. Never seen again. Definitely not down at the Cochos. I think somebody looked into where did he end up? I think he was around doing stuff in the 70s. So very good, very exciting stuff we're saying here. New things never said before.
But maybe we need to get to your book or your...
Yeah, we need to get a few quotes
so
in. Or we'll lose our grant if we're not working on what they said we got our grant for. So let's see. We've got page 143. Where's my book? Okay. So there's this quote from Eric McLuhan. So we're at the top of 143, which is a bit of the... here it is. It's a summary of what we were just saying about the big view. In Playboy, he says, computer technology can and doubtless will... is at the bottom of 142. Computer technology can and doubtless will program entire environments to fulfill the social needs and sensory preferences of communities and nations. Now, that happened on an efficient causality level, right? That's the problem we have now, AI. The content, and it's italicized, and that's what I think is really important, the content of that programming is programming, you know, programming... It has two M's, wouldn't you say?
This is
optional.
I don't know when there may be a difference between Canadian and American spelling on that. I'm not sure.
Okay. The content of that programming, however, depends on the nature of future societies. But that is in our own hands. Okay, that's Marshall McLuhan, Playboy magazine, March 69, page 74. But there it is. That's a summation of what he said in another part of the interview about, you know, giving less radio to Venezuela to cool them off. And so then I say, Eric McLuhan's notion of the computer extensions of the brain is too narrow.
Good point.
Oh, you saying something to the dog?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, the dog is coming up trying to beg something, and I'm trying to get him away.
Okay.
Anyway, sorry for the interruption.
So watch what I'm reading here. Eric McLuhan's notion of the computer extension of the brain is too narrow. It misses the live environment and or living organism aspect of the digital proprioceptive and quark-tuned cubed. See the Bob Dobbs quadrant of my tiny note chart. But here's the quote from Eric from his 1998 book, Electric Language, Understanding the Message. Animals evolve by incorporating into their bodies the new technology, whether by growing longer teeth or by modifying their digestive systems. Human evolution works in the opposite manner. With the first inventions, human evolution suddenly shifted from the realm of biology to that of technology. Animals incorporated, we discorporated. We extended into the environment various parts of the body, various limbs and organs, and with electricity, the central nervous system. most recently Computer Technology and Its Children, now extend around the globe, the hemispheres, and other elements and organs of the brain. It remains only to extend the mind itself. Now, I say to people when I'm trying to explain tactility that it's not a sense, it's the interplay of the senses. That, I say, for on the popular level, is the mind. So it remains only to extend the mind itself, but the way I use mind in explaining tactility, we're already extending the mind. Now, he has another quote where the later digital technologies are extensions of the parts of the brain, different aspects in the brain, which could be what he says here. We're extending the mind itself. So then I say, Eric McLuhan, so Eric is seeing the final extensions of humans before you look at the planet as an extension through the satellite, is parts of the brain, and that's a digital. But I say it this way. I say the machines are extending the machines. They're not extending us anymore. They're not extending parts of the brain. They're extending whatever they are digitally. So I say Eric McLuhan doesn't see the machines extending themselves. He sees us extending intricate and subtle parts of the brain. He's still keeping technologies categorized as extensions of our bodies. He doesn't take the process to extensions independent of our faculties. And if we're still extending technology within our body, then we should be able to make ethical decisions to turn off certain media environments, if only occasionally. He wrote the quotation above 20 years ago. So I'm saying this in 2019, say, 2018. We haven't seen much progress by Eric on that front. It seems a bit of an intellectual cop-out. Extend the mind itself. That's vague. And I just already explained how mind is tactility. I focus on the live environment aspect and suggest Eric misses that dimension. Does that prompt you to say anything? What I'm saying there about Eric?
Well, I mean, I think I like the idea that the live environment was very important for McLuhan. Because it fits in with his idea that personal identity is going to be lost or is already lost, and whatever new identity we have is going to be networked, and it's it's going to be an environmental effect, not some sort of body effect or ownership effect.
Yeah, it's going to be within the technical environment itself. That's extending in itself, not within our bodies. And you see the way Croker writes about it, he says surplus flesh becomes surplus. It's just sitting on the sidelines watching the next level of technological evolution, and is quite adrift and agog and has no clue what's going on. And maybe feels greatly alienated. The thing that media are extensions of us, that McLuhan lays out in Understanding Media, needs to be restated and clarified that it is us, but it is, looks like it's machines extending themselves. So use a bunch of words to reconnect ourselves to the machines, because most people are intuiting with their bias that they're not being extended anymore. Something else is, and then that's expressed by AI and the new panic about AI can't be controlled anymore. It's going to make us extinct, which is the latest fad the past couple of months is these guys, Yudkowsky and Schmachtenberger, are out there telling us that the Social Dilemma guys, they are saying it in their new movie called, or film, whatever it is, AI Dilemma. They're saying it's extending itself and nobody knows how it's doing it and it's not in our control anymore. That's the panic of the last couple of months. Have you picked up on it?
Yeah, well, certainly there's, you can't look at the news these days without seeing something about AI.
Yeah, and Hinton at the University of Toronto, he quit Google.
Yeah.
I started it.
excuse me. I just wanted to point out that one of the great problems with this whole area is that when we talk about what is body or what is technology or what is identity and stuff. We don't really know what we're talking about with these words.
Yeah.
And all of them need to be redefined. And we're sort of just products of their confusion at the present time.
Yep.
Right? So it's not as if these things are as we take them to be at the present moment. They are just artifacts of confusion. But on the other side of confusion, which is where McLuhan wants to locate himself, these things can be restated, they can be relived, but in an entirely different sense from the way they're currently stated or currently lived.
Yeah, the specialisms don't work anymore, the categories.
Correct.
Jack Sarfatti should welcome amateurs who have done maybe some McLuhan study. You got to do the basics, got to learn the new science, and then he engages his physics with what they come up with or with what I came up with, you know, not say, oh, that you're not talking in my language, you're not using the proper formulas, therefore we can't talk about it. No, this is the democratic effect we've gotten to today, and McLuhan used to say, let's have a TV show, lay out our problems, and someone in the audience will solve it. So that's what the Internet has brought with social media. It got everybody talking in a global classroom or a global seminar with, you know, 5 billion people contributing to it. That's where we're at now. And is there, a necessary conclusion that we have to come up with? We have to say, okay, now we know what the environment is. Now we know what identity is. Don't know if that ever happened. There won't be a finish line, but there can't be people getting paid $300,000 after teaching for 35 years, and there's some kind of pope in their field that everybody has to pay respects to, because we now know, just like they say, all the institutions are suspected now of not being worthy of anything they say about in America. Well, all forms of knowledge are, and nobody can lord it over anybody anymore. Everybody is part of the dialogue. Now, I guess if you're good at it, you might get a bit of prominence, and everybody looks at your YouTube for a while, or your Zooms, but it won't last long, because something else will come up. So this is finding its wake, you know? The whole world and all the languages talking.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So there's Finnegan's Wake, the most, on the surface, for literate people, the most difficult book ever. No, it's a simple book once you get these points that McLuhan figured out. And then the Finnegan's Wake can be the standard text or map or agenda that always reminds you of what we're in the middle of, because it's always painted on every page. So I went forward with that in 1980, mid-80s in Toronto. I started the damn school, the new school. Here it is 40 years later and still carrying on. But nobody went forward and made a big deal out of Finney's Wake as a democratic thing that anybody could get involved with. That's pretty radical, right?
Yeah.
Most people didn't even know of the book. So so I wrote to somebody that McLuhan says he got it from Lewis, but actually – Pound, Eliot, Joyce, Lewis, and Yeats all had aspects of what was coming, the tech body. They intuited early parts of it. And McLuhan saw that, so he juggled those five guys and all the other people we just mentioned tonight, because he kept adding to the team, and he juggled all these people, and he came up to the closest approximation of the tech body, according to Ion. That's where Ion comes in. But the... not so obvious to anybody who reads McLuhan, unless they get this live point that we just said, that the environment is alive. So what you're saying, what I'm saying, we're doing, and all are invited to contribute. But you're not going to get much response from me if you haven't done some basics, which is look at the elements that you said had to be done 200 years ago with chemistry. You've got to familiarize yourself with, what would you call it? The program? What is it? What are we? What is the element that McLuhan discovered or stated?
Well, I mean, I would prefer to say that he discovered the elementary structure of experience, and the elementary structure of experience is the medium is the message.
So Barry, Nevin, you say that McLuhan discovered an epistemology of experience. Does that work, that word epistemology? Is that what you're saying?
Yes, but epistemology by itself is like an air balloon. Epistemology needs to be based in ontology, right? Theory of knowledge needs to be based in ontology, a theory of reality.
Right, so it should be an ontology and epistemology of experience, not just epistemology.
Right.
Okay, that's good.
But this relates to what you were just saying in the sense that we're suddenly in a situation that's like the 1700s of alchemy. But instead of there being different alchemists in different labs coming up with different ideas of what they're doing, we now have sort of one universal lab in which everybody can participate, but there's universal confusion about what we're doing.
Yeah.
And so what McLuhan is saying is, well, folks, let's do some pattern recognition here. Let's try and see what's going on in everything we're already doing. And if we can come up with the patterns, then we don't need a pope that is in charge of the discipline.
Yeah.
The discipline itself will be what supplies the coherence.
Yeah.
Right? Because we will have things that we can focus on that people agree we need to focus on. And when we focus on them, we will make them more precise. And they will generate questions and answers on their own. And that will be what modulates the environments of the world.
Yeah.
Not nothing at the level of,
computers.
National thermostats.
The global thermostat, that's right.
Yeah.
Yeah, so maybe that's what the White House is. The White House is the attempt to be the thermostat. And they don't know what they're doing.
Correct.
And the White House has been that way for years.
Yeah, yeah. That's the American experience, you could say.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, look at how much they make out of the election. They never stop. It goes on day in, every year. Somebody gets elected, then they're on to what's going to happen to the next guy, or is there going to be a next guy? There's just too much ridiculous emphasis on the position of the White House. You know, they spend $2 billion to get a $200,000 a year job. But I'm explaining, we know why they are obsessed with the White House. That's their ontology. That's their epistemology, is the White House and what it represents. So it's the global thermostat, the modulator.
Which is the Gutenberg galaxy, which is the individual point of view seeing the individual perspective.
And the literate bureaucracy, which is not a bureaucracy anymore, other than it's an afterimage of a bureaucracy, what they call
Correct.
A government.
Yeah, it's a body for clipping coupons.
Right, and so you have today, do we have the image of the government is in chaos and no department is listening to any other department. They can't get the Department of Justice to, Congress can't get them to investigate anything that Congress is looking into. Right now, the Republican-led Congress. So I think that was very exciting what we're saying right here. We're explaining why this is, we have a basic language. We have the Esperanto that Joyce and these people were looking for through McLuhan as a jumping off point. So Croker said that he was looking for a language, and I think he thought he found the language with his book, The Data Trash, 1994, with Michael Weinstein. They thought they had established the language. Now, you got to say, no, McLuhan got there first. McLuhan got the language, and then see what Croker adds to it. If he refines, changes the McLuhan language. But I would say McLuhan got the language first, the way you describe chemistry. He got the elementals. And that is a way to talk about everything. And
this closely relates to everything we were saying before about the art historians and the style historians.
Yeah.
Lewis and Joyce. I mean, everybody for at least a century and a half has felt this need to find a way of talking about the human fate, and we haven't found it. That's where we are right now. People like McLuhan had great suggestions, and they may have found the answer, but they didn't. They haven't found a way to communicate.
Well, I say we did. We did.
How
find
do you mean?
It. With all kinds of what is the word? All kinds of apologies or corrections to what we just said. Endless corrections to that sentence. We discovered it, but I would add that it's not what you thought we discovered, and we're not sure what you think we discovered.
Right. So for me, the proof is in the pudding.
I'm sick of that pudding. I've had enough of that.
The world is clearly showing that nobody got the message.
Okay, so then... we did that quote. Eric is falls short there for the language purposes, and then we have two quotes to emphasize the liveness at the top of page 144. So in War and Peace in the Global Village, page 36, McLuhan says the important thing is to realize that electric information systems are live environments in the full organic sense. Now here it is. That's 1968. So 55 years later, almost 60 years later, a lot of millions of people would understand that or think they understood it, would accept the words that the environment has come alive. That's what they call AI. So when McLuhan said in 1970 that Eliot's auditory imagination was a common experience, but sending his wake was still unknown and unconscious, and that was not anybody's experience, we now have arrived at Finnegan's Wake as people's experience, and this point that environments are alive. And that's the tech body. So then the second quote, a few months later, March 69 in Playboy, McLuhan says, our whole cultural habitat, which we once viewed as a mere container of people, is being transformed by these media and by space satellites into a living organism, itself contained within a new macrocosm or connubium of a superterrestrial nature. Now, I would say that must be what Ion's referring to when he says McLuhan was the only one who got intuited the tech body. Those two quotes show that. So we're now moving into this living thing, and this is, phase two of the Android meme coming up to the tech body. See? That's what we're getting. We're quite far along in the essay here.
Yeah, for sure.
When you
think about live environments, do you think about them as sort of Janus-faced, so that one face is the tech body, but another face is the possibility of sort of universal research establishing a new human identity?
Well, I don't know what I mean. So I'm beginning here with McLuhan establishing something.
Uh-huh.
And then the rest of this essay will be trying to figure out what it means or the implications of it. So the Janus face could be tech body versus Android meme. Or now we have a new thing. And Ayn's doing a lot on AI. AI is the baby of the tech body. So Ion's going into its own eccentric explanation of what AI is, and it's a problem right today. But stepping back to the tech body, which is what I began with, I didn't have the AI term, which just showed up a couple months ago in Ion land. So I'm stepping back, trying to figure out the tech body. So I would juxtapose the tech body versus the Android meme. The Android meme is a more passive, it's the couch that people sit in, and then they put a virtual helmet on their face and massage their brains and being with, and that's the tech body. So the tech body is a psychopathic extension of the Android meme that disrupts the silent sea that is the Android meme. So there I am, grabbing words, trying to make something out of it. Don't know if it communicates. But I want to continue reading as I try to answer your question.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, there's no problem with that.
Yeah. So after those two quotes that nobody paid attention to in the 1670s that McLuhan was saying it, there were science fiction guys starting to write about it. I guess Philip K. Dick tried to express it in his different stories. Maybe J.G. Ballard, maybe some other guys I don't know about. But Croker comes up, shows up, familiar with those guys, and quite informed on McLuhan and has the advantage of later technology to look at. So here's what I say. By the 90s, it seemed that the only writer, this is on the, we're on page 144.
44.
Yeah, after the two live quotes from 68 and 69 by McLuhan. So I say, by the 90s, it seemed that the only writer tackling the new shrunken digital membrane was Dr. Arthur Croker. I had coined the phrase Android meme by the mid-90s, so I was delighted to see that we were almost on the same page with his terms like Android flesh and floating organs without bodies, that's in quotes, floating organs without bodies, not Deleuze and Guattari's, quote, bodies without organs. These are split off organs floating, not just bodies. The bodies have been smashed, splattered. Then I say, I created a chart illustrating our kindred visions in 1995. So then you can look at the chart. Then I say, McLuhan enjoyed a minor revival in the 90s through magazines like Mondo 2000, in brackets, Recombinant Synesthesia and Neo Psychedelia. That is, Croker uses the word recombinant. I don't know if Mondo did. This might be Croker talking about Mondo 2000. But anyways, there are the words, Recombinant Synesthesia. So that's technology extending its own synesthesia. Recombinant Synesthesia and Neo Psychedelia, and also Wired magazine, which in brackets, digital recombinant commodities. Yeah, those are Croker terms. So Mondo 2000 doesn't know it's doing recombinant synesthesia and Neo Psychedelia. They're just a bunch of old hippies there out in San Francisco. And Wired, they're doing celebrating digital recombinant commodities, all the digital internet apps that were starting in the 90s. So McLuhan enjoyed a minor revival because Mondo 2000 and Wired, they saw McLuhan as anticipating more of the psychology of their tactile and proprioceptive lifestyles. Now, everybody is feeling tactile and proprioceptive, but they don't know they've been usurped by the Android meme doing the tactile and proprioception, independent of people, even though it's going inside people. McLuhan's program of collective media fasts was not on their horizon of awareness. They were actually fulfilling a little-known prediction by McLuhan in 1968, millenary ecstatics. That was the phrase McLuhan came up with. And it was the only place I've ever seen it is in this collection of criticism of McLuhan, articles on McLuhan called McLuhan Pro and Con, edited by Raymond Rosenthal in 1968. You'll see the phrase. Do you know that phrase, millenary ecstatics?
I didn't, so I looked it up.
Good.
And it's not in an essay by McLuhan. It's in an essay by a guy with a sort of Polish name, Klonsky, Milton Klonsky.
Right.
Mentions it in his essay.
In that book?
Yeah, in that book.
Okay, well,
he says that that was the name of the course that McLuhan gave at Fordham.
Yeah, but you don't think it was?
Oh, I don't know.
Well, yeah,
there's nothing I would argue about.
Beg your pardon?
I would not argue about it if Klonsky says that's what he was what the course was. I'm happy to accept that.
Oh, you mean Klonsky is saying that's the name of McLuhan's course in McClonsky's essay?
Yeah. He doesn't exactly say that. I'll read you what he says. He says, McLuhan is well known as a convert to Catholicism, bracket, now teaching a course in millenary ecstatics at Fordham. So it may just be a phrase that Klonsky made up.
Right. Well, wait a minute. Now, is that page 137?
Yes, sir.
Because in my mind, in the introduction, Rosenthal says the title, and I thought it was millennial ecstatics. I've got to go back and
maybe
look. It may be said twice.
When I search the book is searchable at the Internet Archive. That's what I have open here. And if you search ecstatics, you only get one hit. So it wouldn't matter if it was millenary or millennial. It would still just come up with the one hit.
Yeah, I don't know why in my mind all these years I thought it was in the introduction to the book, and Rosenthal is saying, quoting McLuhan, saying that's the title of his course at Fordham. So I don't know where I got that idea. Maybe misread it in 68 and then stayed there. But I had to look up the page number, and it's not the beginning. It's the page 137, so I didn't notice somehow. It didn't change my image that it was in Klonsky's, that he created it. So I'm not sure about that now. Anyways, the phrase...
Well, it's an interesting phrase, anyway.
Yeah, so in the tiny note chart, I have the Dobbs quadrant contains the other four quadrants, or frames them. And I have the characteristics of ecstasy, and the others have paranoia or schizophrenia or hysteria or panic.
Yeah.
So since the Dobbs quadrant swallows the other four, I am doing millennial ecstatics, and Croker and these guys are ecstatics in their creations. They're just pouring out their stuff. So that's partly what I'm being when I'm saying my quadrant is ecstatics. I'm thinking of McLuhan framing it with this millennial ecstatics, and he says that in 68, and then 30 years later, I make a chart of the millennial ecstatics since 68. Up till the 90s, I made the chart in 95. So that's part of the thinking and the structure of the chart. But anyway,
I just want to note that ecstatic names what McLuhan usually calls extension, and extension is what is structured by media.
Right, but see, and remember, extension is games in understanding media. Games are extensions of man. Now, he repeats the title under the chapter on games. So everything's a game or art forms. The thing is that the ecstatics is the revolutions with the chemical body and all kinds of forms. That is the content while the chemical body is being completely obsolesced by the beginning of the tech body coming in, early phases, the Android meme. And so everybody's celebrating the triumph of what we have achieved, and we don't know, we've just offed ourselves, which is the fear now of AI making humans extinct, right? That's the projection of the panic in the 60s. So so millennial ecstatics is the content of human activity in the 60s and 70s in the global theater or the global membrane. So I'm trying to say something here, and I'm saying something's afoot. Croker, I say, Arthur Croker picked up where Jean Baudrillard left off. Baudrillard was talking about the medium, in quotes, medium, and the message, in quotes, in the late 70s. But he overlaid a genetic DNA model because that was the figure of the playing with gene cells and viruses, which was called recombinant genetics by Croker. Remember, I was telling you how nothing was changing in the 80s and 90s. They were just selling new, shinier products. The format of computers didn't change. No breakthrough in the digital structure, like even going beyond digital. All of the products were just replays, cliche probes, with Croker calling them digital recombinant commodities. That's Groundhog Day, the popular Bill Murray movie in 1993. It's a recombinant day, nothing new, just devices replayed in different orders. Wired magazine was created to sell Wired products. Croker was critiquing Wired for being an agency of leaden consumerism of recombinant commodities. As we move into the 80s, people are starting to become kings and queens in extremis. That's the ecstatics. They're beginning to be put on pedestals. Media are shrinking. People, in quotes, are getting really big, quotes, when they acquire their own computer and cell phone and can walk around mobile. It's a new kind of psychology, not Freudian or Jungian psychology. It's the psychology of global theater occupants. And that theater is tactile and proprioceptive. Doing yoga is proprioceptive, for example. So I don't repeat it there, but the theater, the psychology of global theater is millennial ecstatics. McLuhan was enjoying his minor revival, and the Android meme was recycling recombinant products, both hardware and software, but humans in quotes, because there ain't no humans anymore, but humans saw McLuhan as anticipating more the psychology of their tactile proprioceptive lifestyles. A lot of people, they still were thinking in terms of their bodies and its sensory makeup, but it's the tactile structure. A lot of people would read Understanding Media and they'd get some personal satisfaction out of it. They had no clue. They couldn't see the sociological and literary aspects of it. They couldn't see what environments were. They couldn't see what environments were unfolding. McLuhan described the electrical age as a time of flow and flux. People took the flow flux personally and wanted that kind of imagined freedom while strutting around in a supermarket. They interpreted the content of the book as a projection of their tactile, I guess I mean McLuhan's book. They interpreted the content of McLuhan's book as a projection of their tactile and proprioceptive lifestyles. The user is content, naturally. You don't have to own a computer to be tactile and proprioceptive. You just have to be in the 20th century. Well, you don't have to own a computer to be tactile and proprioceptive. If you're already tactile and proprioceptive, but it becomes an emphasis in your sensory life when you're in a tactile extended environment. That's the proper way to say that. You just have to be in the 20th century with the extension of tactility. In an obscure book, a collection of essays on McLuhan by Raymond Rosenthal, and on page 137, there's a little note that McLuhan had been at Fordham University in the Bronx from 67 to 68, and he offered a course on millennial ecstatics. Now, you're looking at it in the printout there. It's millennial, not millennial, correct?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Millennial.
Well, I guess I saw it that way, even though I used to remember it as millennial, I think. He foresaw millennial, I saw it when I looked it up and had to do it the way it was. He foresaw millennial ecstatics as what was parallel to all the serious ecological concerns of the 80s and 90s. So as people got more and more stressed out, they also had time or another body to do ecstatics in, the electric extended body, leading up to 2000 Common Era. People were having a good, that's the year 2000, Y2K year. People were having a good and unique time in a variety of innumerable ways. That was one of the trends he predicted, millennial ecstatics, including the religious ecstatics, that's in quote, of people celebrating how the Bible's book of Revelation wraps it all up, ends the human era, and Jesus comes back. That's a particular American phenomenon, America being a culture that's built on the printed book. The average person would go to the Bible as the archetypal printed book that America was based on, and that's the icon of identity for Americans, the book. Also, McLuhan wanted people to turn media off, have a collective media fast, and that was not on the horizon of even the later revival of McLuhan. They just wanted to live their druggy, allopathic and recreational drugs, that's what that means. They wanted to live their druggy, wired lives, while McLuhan on the surface seemed to be a celebrant of that digerati culture. They didn't notice he wanted to shut it down temporarily. Everybody was digging their digital antics. They were replaying 1968's millennial ecstatics. the simulation of choice for people in the 90s before the dot-com crash of April 2000. So that's a big mouthful. And then I have a quote. McLuhan used the word brain pan in the 60s. So why do I say that? So in the text, after what I just read, the global membrane, Android mean phase 1, see above, was the actual hidden ground of the 1960s to 1990 period, not the global theater. And it wasn't noticed until the Internet, in brackets, information superhighway, that was the first term for it, was dumped into the brain pan of the super angelic consumer after 1995. So then I say where brain pan comes from. McLuhan used that word in the 60s. The concept of the super angel was probably the most important contribution by McLuhan to the Internet and World Wide Web era. The background to the concept slash percept, colon, McLuhan had met Wyndham Lewis in 1943 in the Detroit area, and they spent much of their subsequent conversations discussing the concept of the superhuman. These discussions are presented in Lewis's novel, Self-Condemned, which came out in 1954, wherein one of the discussants is based on McLuhan. He is Professor Ian McKenzie, see page 312. Ian McKenzie is a person in Dartmouth, Nova Scotia, who one night at a party we were talking, and I think he said, he was a younger guy, and he said, "So what? How would you define God, Bob?" And I, in my memory, I think I said something like, "Well, God is and isn't." And he goes, "That's it. That's it. You defined it. Oh, my God." He starts running around the party telling everybody, "I define God." Now, that was the first time I communicated effectively.
At last.
At last. It inspired somebody, and I've been doing it ever since. But the what's funny is I, years later, I find out the guy that I turned on was Ian McKenzie, and that's the name of McLuhan. So me to Ian McKenzie is Wyndham Lewis to Ian, to Professor McKenzie or McLuhan. Lewis gave McLuhan insights. He helped McLuhan see what God was. I did it to my personal Ian McKenzie. There's the synchronicity of language on a bird's eye view. You
so,
get it?
When you say that these discussions are presented in Lewis's novel Self-Condemned, you're talking about the discussions between McLuhan and Wyndham Lewis, right?
The characters in the book are Rene Harding, based on Lewis, when he's stuck in North America during World War II, and he meets this professor who is modeled on McLuhan, literally.
Yeah,
You can tell. And they talk about the superhuman. That's what they talk about in the novel.
Yeah, but what I'm trying to bring out is you're not saying that the superhuman is first treated by Lewis in Self-Condemned. You're saying that Self-Condemned treats the superhuman as discussed by McLuhan and Lewis, but you're
in
not 43. Excluding.
In 43. The book comes out 10 years later.
Yeah, no, I understand that. But I'm just trying to bring out the point that the superhuman in Lewis is not a new theme in Self-Condemned.
Well,
right?
The first time, I don't know if he has the... He might have the word in other essays of the time. Is that what you mean?
No, isn't the superhuman an aspect of the human age?
Yes, let me see, which is what I bring up in the next paragraph. I just finished the human age. Did I tell you that?
Yeah, we discussed it last time, actually.
Yeah, so I hadn't finished it then, but I finished it last week. And what a great, incredible book. And here's an interesting pattern. Some critic writing about some Lewis scholar, he says the missing link is you have Aldous Huxley, Brave New World, Orwell, 1984, and then you jump to the 60s, 70s, and 80s, and you've got J.G. Ballard and some other guy I didn't really recognize, forget his name, But in between, on the way from Huxley Orwell to J.G. Ballard and the other guy, is Wyndham Lewis's Human Age. It is the missing science fiction thing that is appropriate to our time that McLuhan explained. That's what you need. We need to throw that in. Nobody knows that Lewis did this, that he wrote a science fiction novel that it goes further than Orwell, who was inspired by Lewis, and Aldous Huxley, but doesn't quite get to the postmodern, whatever you call Ballard and those guys. Ballard, maybe Philip K. Dick, but the writer didn't say Dick. He named some other guy. So that's really, never heard of that before. Lewis is Human, but I didn't know it. I hadn't read it. Once I read it and then read the review, I said, that guy's right. This needs to be part of the great dystopias, I guess you'd call it. Brave New World and Orwell first, and then Lewis, and then these later guys, J.G. Ballard. Mm-hmm. It's an important point that I find important. Nobody knows Lewis. They don't read him. And so they don't know that he's up there with Orwell. So back to what you're... Does he say superhuman in there? Maybe. It's all about angels. And it's all about the devil's, Lucifer's project to turn the angels into humans, to become humans. And you'll see in Exploration number 8, at the back of the book, there's a bunch of little essays by other people, including McLuhan. It's called Third Program in the Human Age, and he talks about this very point of the angelization of Hollywood and the angels invading Hollywood to take over the world because they're pissed off that humans have become discarnate angels or superhuman, and they're obsolescing angels. So this is battle. That's what the third book's about, one of the main themes. That does include the superhuman in retrospect, but I don't know if that word is in the Human Age.
Right. I wasn't talking about vocabulary. I was just talking about the theme.
Yeah. The angelization of humans, which is the phrase McLuhan used in the 70s, I think Lewis is saying that because there's a problem for the angels. Because of that, so they have to become human. They got to flip. So it's quite an amazing concept, as science fiction. So, and this is written the same year that Self-Condemned comes out. I mean, he puts Human Age comes out in 55, so he wrote it in 51, 52, 53, 54, and that's the same year as he's writing Self-Condemned. So they go together.
But you mentioned in here that the first edition of Human Age came out already in the 20s, I think.
1928. Yep.
Yeah.
That's Chalmers. And that is what's odd is you don't know if Lewis had this vision, which doesn't get done for 25 years, in 28. I don't think there's anything about angels in book one. It ends with them just arriving at hell or some preparatory city before you get to hell, and it's called the Magnetic City. But they're at a camp on the outskirts of Magnetic City. So you know how McLuhan used that phrase a lot, Magnetic City. That's what it's called in Chalmers. So it's it'd have to be discussed. You'd have to read it. And then I see what you think, because the first 122 pages, which everybody regards as an extreme experimental introduction to a book, you got to wade through 122 pages of these two guys, and you don't know where they are or what they're doing and why they're hallucinating on the environment and themselves and their interaction. It's quite a mystery landscape that goes on for a long time, and most people probably can't read it. It just gets too boring and ridiculous because it has no reference point. And then they finally get to the camp, which is run by the bailiff who works for Lucifer. That's how the book ends. And you don't get the angel dimension until the end of book two. So I don't know what Lewis, when he figured it out to do that, to finish the trilogy that way.
Yep.
Maybe I'll ask a scholar in the next meeting that. What, do they know this angel point? And what would they say to that question? Okay, so anyways, so I have here Lewis published after talking about Self-Condemned, where they the characters based on conversation McLuhan had with Lewis in 43-44 about the superhuman. Lewis published two more novels in 1955, Monster Gay and Malign Fiesta, parts 2 and 3 of his trilogy, The Human Age, begun in 1928, I would add, with the Childer Mass, or Massacre of the Innocents, wherein Lewis explored Hollywood as an environment of discarnate angelic humans, which caused the original astral angels to invade and take over the City of Angels. See third program in The Human Age, Exploration Magazine, number 8, part 2, page 18. So that's what I was referring to. And it's called Angel Town, interesting development. I won't tell you what happens, how that surfaces. So then I say, just as the angels were outraged that humans developed language, this is a replay of that occasion with a later kind of language, movies. That irritated the angels, the same conflict. Then I write, from superhuman to super angel. McLuhan pointed out in the 70s that an angel could be anywhere, but only there before moving on to another there, so in a sequential manner. So they could be anywhere, but when they were someplace, that's all they were. They were only there, but then they could go to every other there. Eventually, the angel would or could experience everywhere. They'd go to every there or everywhere. However, the human, engaging the electronic services of the global membrane, what McLuhan termed the discarnate condition, could be everywhere simultaneously and immediately, no sequentiality involved. Imagine that you were broadcasting on the radio to 500,000 people. Each one of those private listener environments would have a piece of you in them via the radio. And each one of the 500,000 listeners would have a piece occupying your studio, passively present in your environment. Pieces in quotes. Then once telephones for live call-ins were added, everybody could potentially be actively in every other listener's home. The condition presented on every page of Finnegan's Wake. Then I quote page 108, here calls everywhere is in Finnegan's Wake. No angel could do this, but the human come super angel did. And that's something that McLuhan pointed out. I'm quoting McLuhan there. I'm not quoting where he said it, but he did say somewheres that we are greater than the angels because we can be everywhere simultaneously rather than sequentially. It may have been on an audio. You know, it may not be written anywhere. It may be in one of Nelson's classroom recordings.
Well, it may be in the Global Village.
Okay.
He has that chapter on the discarnate.
Yeah, but he calls the angel visual space and the robot acoustic space. He gets it backwards. The angel is not visual space. It is compared to the super angel. There's a bit of positioning there, eyeball location when you're there and you can't be any other there till you get there. But the invisible extended tactility that humans have been living under in the digital world, we all interface with each other. We all inside each other, which is a quote from, I think, Stephen Harrow by James Joyce that McLuhan has in one of those early 1950 essays on Joyce and the poetic process. He begins with that quote, that we're all inside each other's digestive system. That is the superhuman. That's a super angel. So I'm bringing in the idea of the super angel. But I had been up before that talking about the superhuman. So I then say on page 148 at the top, this capacity would result in a completely different consequence from that of the old superhuman. McLuhan had upgraded Lewis's insights. So he's discussing the superhuman, which is simple discarnate state under analog electric media or radio conditions in the 40s. But then that gets reprivatized virtually in the digital social media environment. So there you become a super angel. So I'm saying here that Lewis goes past. Imagine trying to explain this to the Lewis professors. McLuhan had upgraded Lewis's insight. No, he didn't. He just ripped off Lewis. That's what they would say. No, he altered it and improved on it. So then I say the superhuman is the conceptual content of Self-Condemned, the novel, wherein the guest professor René Harding, who's based on Wyndham Lewis during the World War II exile in North America, René Harding is interacting at the university with Professor Ian McKenzie, who's based on Marshall McLuhan. And it's about the dialogues they had when they met in 43. They're discussing Friedrich Nietzsche's Superman or superhuman. They're arguing over the super Gnosticism of the 20s and 30s, symbolized by people like Nietzsche and Adolf Hitler. That's the superhuman. But Lewis discovered the angelic competitors of the superhuman. Then McLuhan later refined what it meant, as explained above. Once in the Internet World Wide Web surrounds, I write, the super angel became her own intelligence agency. This is precisely the meaning of the vague phrase, the post-human. McLuhan got there first in his nomenclature. Then I had myself, it's not post-human, it's the super angelic happening. But all this background exegesis is a preparation for the far more difficult and strange situation of the tech body. And that maybe is where we should end. But then there's a good quote from Croker. This is Croker. Why don't I give the sources of it?
Yeah, you do on the next page. It's all a long quotation.
Yeah, okay.
Gets extended around your comment.
All right, let's read this whole thing, and then we'll go over it next time. But it's a pretty good description of the tech body in the 90s, before the tech body showed up, so to speak. Circuited by all the flows of power, patterned by code works, says Croker, shaped by norms of cultural intelligibility, an object of viral invasion, with its subjectivity increasingly taking the form of possessed individualism. All of that, the body can acquire such a powerful epistemological presence as a universal sign because the bodies that we are or would like to become are themselves increasingly dispersed, intermediated, unfinished, spliced, straining. And then I go a couple of words there. I say, that's the fate of the chemical body. The first two lines above that I just read are qualifiers of the body aspects. It's an object of our invasion. Quote, subjectivity increasingly taking the form of possessed individualism, shaped by norms of cultural intelligibility, patterned by code works. Then we go back to the Croker quote, and he says, nothing is as imaginary as the material body. So your physical body is now imaginary. Circulating, fluid, borderless, with no certain boundaries or predetermined history, the body has no meaning today other than its intermediations, no autobiography that does not possess its own ontologies. That's a word from Derrida. And certainly no drift that does not leave a trace of its presence. There certainly are codes of gender that can be transgressed only at the price of punishment, but there are always, that's transgender stuff today. Croker's anticipating that. There definitely are codes of gender that can be transgressed only at the price of punishment, but there are always gender drifters who remix, recombine, and resplice the codes of gender performance. There certainly is a disciplinary regime of sexuality, but there are also sex code drifters who make of their own sexual assignment an opportunity to transgress the codes, to refuse the normative, to overcome the predetermined. Against class inequities burned into disciplined laboring bodies, there are class drifters who make of their own protesting, rebelling, insurgent bodies a marker of the struggle for freedom. While the age of specialization resulted in the definitive separation of the senses, body drift begins with a grand unification of the human sensorium. That's Arthur Croker in a book called Body Drift, subtitled Butler, Hales, and Haraway. Those are three feminists. And Butler is considered the ideologue that ruined the millennials and younger with the transgender stuff that is a plague today. The people investigating go back to Butler, but Croker is celebrating Butler here, and Hales and Donna Haraway. 2012, page 3. Now, what a mouthful of, I don't want to say bullshit, but we're certainly going to have Cameron go over this and correct a lot of it. Right, Cameron?
Well, I don't know, Bob. I'll be interested to hear your
my corrections.
Yeah.
It's quite a quote, eh?
It is.
And that's where, you know, he does add a Baroque spiral to McLuhan. I guess like McLuhan did to Lewis. Definitely Croker is describing a lot more than the simple word discarnate, which is as far as McLuhan got. You know, these details are pretty interesting.
Yeah, I think that was a good idea you had to read this and to suggest some thinking about it before the next time.
Yeah.
Because it's way too much to grapple with on one reading. It needs to be reread and rethought.
Yeah,
and
we'll be going over it a lot.
That's what I'll do. Yeah.
So, and it's time to end anyway, so perfect. It's tremendous. I'm going to write down those seven names, this new chain reaction we have.
Yeah.
From Hildebrand. Hildebrand to Carpenter.
Yes, sir.
All right. So thanks a lot. Very good discussion. And
okay, Bob. Thank you.
And we'll talk soon.
Good.
Okay, bye.
Bye.